Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, now in depth on why even the same degree doesn't guarantee the same pay. Do you go to a male dentist or a female dentist? Is your doctor a woman or a man? If you're having your teeth or your overall health cared for by a woman, that physician or dentist is almost guaranteed to be making less than her male colleague. Why? How is it justifiable that the average pay for a male dentist in 2010 was $185,000 and some change, and the average pay for a female dentist in 2010 was $120,000? And some change. The same holds true for doctors, according to the American Dental Association. And by the way, Minnesota has a gender pay equity law for all state employees, but we also have a gap in gender pay here in this state and this region. Today, a conversation about what will actually change the pay inequity. And I'd really love to hear from you this morning. As women, are you in a field where you know there's pay inequity? What does that mean for your own plans and ambitions? And men, are you also in a field that pays women with the same qualifications, education, and experience less? What do you think the answer is to that? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, where I've tweeted out a couple questions, it's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Elise Gould is with us. She's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, where she specializes in wages and economic mobility. And she's with us today from D.C. And Elise, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having this conversation and inviting me.
Rhonda Vanjie-Sharp is with us. She's president and founder of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. And she's with us from Mechanicsville, Virginia. And Rhonda, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. Good morning to you both. Good morning, Elise.
Good morning. Good to have you here, Rhonda. Elise, your research aligns with this American Dental Association study in that it shows that the same education and the pay gap remains stubbornly persistent. Tell me a little bit more about the research so you can put this in context for us.
Sure. If we look at the pay gap across almost every occupation, across education levels, across the country, you see that there is a substantial gap between how much men are being paid and how much women are being paid. So if you look almost every occupation, regardless of whether that occupation is traditionally held by men or women, you're going to find a substantial gap in pay.
And what are the reasons for that? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think that there are, when you look within occupations, there is certainly room for discrimination. Also, the reason why some women would be in different occupations than in others is a result of a lifetime of differential treatment, right? So it doesn't just happen that people will say, oh, women graduate from college and major in different things than men do. And that that certainly is the case, that men are more likely to graduate in, let's say, STEM fields than women are. But even when you look within STEM fields, women are being paid less than men.
Yeah, and Rhonda, this is where I think this is really obvious and you really can't ignore it. When you look into the advanced degree areas, the pay gap widens. So you have a man and a woman with an advanced degree, and you will see over the years of the career that pay gap is gradually widening. And I wonder if you have some theories about why that is, particularly when it comes to science.
I'm Carrie. I think that's an excellent point. I was just at Howard University at the beginning of the month presenting some research that I'd done years ago and thought, you know, the conversation about the pay equity gap, it's time to revisit it, in which I look at what happens to the gaps as educational attainment changes. And one of the things that that I found is that it gets wider when you're talking at advanced degrees. And I think some of that has to do with how opportunities broaden. So take, for example, women who might have an MBA and men who might have an MBA.
Right.
One of the things that we know in terms of how those occupations then separate is that men will tend to be in finance areas with MBAs And women are more likely to be in HR and marketing. And so when you look at that, you could have the same degree, but then path choices change, which is a lot, which relates to what Elise says in terms of, you know, why might you have this? Her study talks about inflexibility in hours. So if I'm a woman and I'd like to have a family and I'm thinking about advanced degrees, what it means, whether it's a lawyer, a doctor, or an MBA, I may have to choose paths that are going to be more family-friendly in terms of hours that will allow me to take on, again, as she talks about, that burden of household chores that men don't necessarily have. So I think a lot of it has to do with when we're going to graduate school, what are our choices? So if you think about medicine, sometimes you will find that women may choose to be pediatricians,
mm-hmm.
right, which sort of has, you know, that standard, if you want to say 9 to 5, where men may choose occupations that may involve more surgery and things of that sort. So I think when you look at advanced degree, you have similar sorting that you do at the bachelor's level, but the stakes in terms of pay are very different.
Just a couple numbers here, Rhonda, since you mentioned the physician situation here. Male doctors earned an average of $234,200 in 2010 when this was studied. Women doctors earned an average of $89,000 a year less. Elise, I mean, does what Rhonda said about, and we've been hearing this for years, well, women have to make sacrifices to have families, and they have to step out of the career, and they have to choose specialists, specialties that aren't as lucrative. I mean, does that really account? I don't want to ask if it's fair. We'll get to that. But does that really account for the sizable part of the gap?
Certainly, it's the case that if you're trying to make a choice in this constrained world where we have, where there is this tournament-like situation where certain jobs require these long hours, being available nights and weekends, then that is more difficult for women to be able to be in those professions, because even without children, they face more responsibilities at home, either doing more housework or caring for parents or even caring for a spouse's parents. They're more likely to do that because of the perpetuation of the gender wage gap. So because they make less, they're the ones who are going to have to take off the time to do those other responsibilities. And then when kids enter the picture, that is only exacerbated. But I think it's important to come back to the question of, okay, well, these are career choices once you're maybe getting an advanced degree. Even if you were to compare average wages of men with only a college degree, so a BA or a BS degree, men on average are earning more, are being paid more than women with any type of advanced degree. So regardless of, you know, if you look at average across those MDs or those MBAs or those MAs or MS or any of those advanced degrees, on average, their wages are lower than men's wages with only a bachelor's degree.
Michelle says,
I find that incredibly striking.
Yeah. Michelle says, and I think this makes a point, Elise, to what you were saying, I work in higher ed and research. My division hired a guy with zero research experience and who was in high school when I was getting my master's degree. He started at $12,000 higher than I make. When I brought up the disparity, my male boss complained about how underpaid he is, I think meaning the boss. And then Michelle adds, my boss makes 5 times what I make. Is he 5 times smarter or 5 times more hardworking? No, he's just really good at playing like he is. Rhonda, you're chuckling at that. Why?
Because I think that that's her point, is what women run into. So
absolutely,
when you go in to complain about the salary, it is, well, let me tell you about my situation as a way to deflect what's going on. I think the other part that we haven't discussed and has been conversation in the economics profession. So there's an organization called the Committee on the Status of Women in the Economics Profession, and they will talk about negotiating and how women tend not to negotiate. So, and I can remember being falling into this when I was moving out of a postdoc situation and saying, okay, you know, this is what I want, thinking that the employer would come back and say, oh, well, that's way too low, and then having my dissertation advisor go, well, what did you think that they were going to offer? And that it has taken some time to get comfortable with negotiating it. And I think, again, Going back to Elise's study and the comments that she has said today about cultural norms, often we do not rear our daughters to negotiate, right, to bargain and to be very clear about what your worth is. So if you come in starting lower and we think about how raises and whether, you know, it's performance-based, et cetera, you will get, you will always be behind. And so, you know, figuring how to get folks to be more willing to go in to negotiate and be more assertive about your worth, I think helps in some of this. Whereas I think men don't think twice to say, this is a salary that I want coming in off the bat, even if it's way off.
And I'm worth it, right? There's the key. And I have no question about whether I'm worth it. Let me go to some callers here, to Rebecca in Minneapolis. Rebecca, it sounds like this is a deal in your field. You're a member of the clergy. Is that right?
That's right. I'm an ordained clergy person, and I have my doctor of ministry as well. But I, you know, the language we use in our field is the stained glass ceiling. I think the reality is that a lot of women clergy are hired in smaller congregations or perhaps like me do social justice ministry, which are tend to be lower paying positions.
And what's your awareness of how what the pay differences are? I mean, how big is it?
It can be very striking. I have I know one large, what they call a tall steeple congregation, where the senior pastor makes over $200,000, and the associates are more like at the $100,000 range. So, you know, double. And I think, you know, there are some small congregations that pay their clergy in the $30,000 range, and a larger congregation can be paying more like a $75,000. So it's pretty significant.
I have to say, Rebecca, I love the lingo in your trade, the stained glass ceiling and the tall steeple congregation.
Yes.
Thanks very much for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Rebecca, I think you bring up a great point because there is data on that, right? I think that one of the ways in which we can fight against that kind of discrimination that you're facing, even the classist way in which educators within the clergy or social justice workers within the clergy are valued less, right, or being paid less, is their value to that congregation any less? We do see among clergy you can measure differences across congregations, looking at congregational size. You know, how many children are you educated? How many adult members do you have? And be able to make those comparisons, and it can be very stark in terms of people with the same amount of education and experience practicing in a congregation of similar size being paid very differently. And I think the organizational structure can, you know, across congregations across the country, can do a lot of work towards lessening those. Because they have that information and that pay structure, it can be much more apparent where discrimination exists.
You know, Rhonda, the other thing I was thinking about with this, when you were describing, you know, some women, because of obligations with sick parents or home-based obligations, I was thinking, you know, this idea of FaceTime, are you putting in the hours at work where everybody can see you, is an outdated idea. We work differently. We know we're going to continue working differently. You can be just as productive if you are working, you know, the hours pretty much that you decide to work. I'm not saying never showing up, but you know what I'm saying here. It just seems like this whole structure is dated. And if that's where the pay gap begins, then we also have to work on that.
I agree with you in terms of flexibility of hours. But I think the other part of that is sort of the unspoken is, if you're not putting in the FaceTime in the traditional sense, then it becomes sort of the fit. Do you fit? Do I know who you are? If we think about coaches and sponsors or mentors, which, you know, whichever one you prefer in terms of promotion, the person who's going to be promoted is the person that people actually know, right? And it's the same way that we sort of have an understanding of where deals are made, the golf course, right? Which is sort of again a male world, if you're there and you can play the golf, et cetera, then there's a different perception of you. I think the other part of thinking about the face hours is getting folks to be a little more comfortable with outsourcing home responsibility. So I know when we're talking to junior faculty, one of the questions is always, well, what do you do about child care? Mm-hmm. And I remember Joyce Jacobson, who is now provost at Wesleyan College, said, you know, you want to outsource when your kids are small because everybody wants to be with a small child, not necessarily your teenager, which is the reverse of what people think about. And I believe in outsourcing. So, you know, I do a lot. I have someone clean my house, do my laundry, things of that sort. And I'm beginning to tell young folks to do that early, so that when you are married or you do have a family, if you want to do those things, it isn't so odd to you, right? And that in some ways frees you up. But that also goes against some of the cultural norms about what a woman should do with respect to the home.
And really, and Rhonda, what you're talking about here, I'll bring Elise in too, what you're talking about is a lot of cultural norms. Like you fit better in this environment, this work environment, if I can see you at the hours that I am also, you know, I just feel like work should be moving away from that. And I feel like millennials are pushing us away from that and companies are slow to catch up. Elise, would you weigh in on this too?
Yes, absolutely. I think that what we might want to consider is a change of the culture of work.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, So I think the 80-hour job, when we think about whether or not someone is available those nights and those weekends to work that 70th, that 80th hour and be available for those phone calls, I think we should question how productive those hours are, and is that really how we should be encouraging work in this country?
Right.
Because you're available for a phone call, because you can bill that hour, do you think clients really want to be billed that 75th, that 80th hour? How productive really are you compared to 9 o'clock on Monday morning when you're going to be much more productive? There's nothing that says that workers per hour are more productive when they work those kind of hours. It's just the way that the tournament of getting those jobs is done, and that gets perpetuated because the men in those higher-up positions think, well, I paid my dues, I've earned my position in this company, and you have to pay your dues by working those hours. But there's nothing that says that actually rewards the company better by doing that.
All right. Matt in Decorah, Iowa, called to say that he's a business owner, and one reason he thinks there may be a pay gap is that women typically have to take more time off for pregnancy or if their kids are sick, et cetera, which kind of addresses what we were just talking about. And Marty says from Bloomington about the salary negotiation skills. Unless that skill is listed as part of a job description, no one should pay someone more because they have good salary negotiation skills. HR is doing a disservice to the bottom line. But Rhonda, we know that that is a factor, right?
Yes. Yes. And I think the other part, too, is where do you get your information? Right. So, you know, I think men are probably more likely to share and share information about salary and pay perhaps than women are. And as I'm saying that, I'm sort of thinking about maybe they aren't because they're more fearful about if you're making less than some other guy. But I do think that they have access to more information, or maybe a different way to think about that, if we go back to what Elise said about the culture of work, men will be encouraged to be more assertive about things than women do. And there's that Pantene commercial about, you know, when women are assertive, what you get called, and, you know, that B word that
yep.
we hate so much. And it's on the assertiveness, and you have to walk that fine line. But I think that's something that Elise said about men and the culture of work and paying their dues that we want to be very careful about, because I think that there are women who will share that and won't necessarily be as supportive as young women coming in with families if it wasn't what they did.
Right.
Right. And so their attitude will be as well that this is the way that you need to do it because I've done it. I think about it as a sort of hazing that isn't at all productive for the workforce.
Rhonda Vonshin,
right,
Charlotte.
Rhonda, I completely agree. I think that hazing can happen from men and women at the top of an organization saying that they paid their dues. I think it's also important to think about those negotiation skills, and absolutely women could benefit from more negotiation, but there's also evidence that men and women face different social incentives for negotiation and that women are more likely to be penalized when they negotiate. So it's not so clear exactly what you're saying, Rhonda, in terms of walking that line of assertiveness but not aggressiveness. But I think that caller sort of hit the nail on the head when he said that you know, you shouldn't be leaving so much open to negotiation. And if you were to set particular job categories with a particular salary range and not go outside of that, you could also narrow the gender wage gap. You know, you define certain qualifications, certain education, certain experience, and that's what that job is worth. And that's how much someone in that job should get paid.
Rhonda Vonche Sharp, ladies, hang on just once. I just want to remind people who are tuning in what we're talking about. I promise to come right back to this. Rhonda Vonche Sharp with us this morning. She's president and founder of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity and Race. And Elise Gould with us, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. And we are talking about, yes, the sustained and stubborn pay gap between men and women, and some research that informs this conversation that even when women have comparable levels of education and degrees, they are still making less. Rhonda, forgive me. You wanted to add.
No, I was just going to say, even with the pay range, the person on the other side may not necessarily view the male and the female experience coming in equally. I remember a thread on Twitter where a gentleman was saying that his boss was complaining about his female subordinate taking longer to negotiate with clients. And he found that when he was sending out an email to a particular person, the person thought that he was the woman and was giving him pushback.
Wow.
And that's a point that he sort of changed and said, oh, wait. You know, he realized that he was emailing under her email and not his, and said, hey, this is X. The male's name, the person immediately switched. And what he found was it wasn't that it was taking her longer. Hmm. Well, I mean, it was taking her longer, but it was a result of how people were viewing her as a female, given the same advice that he would have given.
Super
right?
Interesting.
So when he was given
wow.
the advice as male, you know, the perception. So I don't disagree with Elise in terms of the salary ranges, but I think even when we're talking about ranges, there is going to be a level of interpretation for what that skill is coming in, right? How that's going to be perceived.
As Stacy says on Twitter, women are making 5% less right out of college. One way to shrink the gap, stop asking for salary history. Amber says, no, two women on Wall Street, West Point grads in same-sex marriage that were both told repeatedly that they made less because they were never having kids. And Ashanta, boy, this stuff really still happens. It does blow my mind. Shanta from Minneapolis. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Well, I formerly worked in the compensation area of human resources, and I'm about to start a PhD program in the sciences this fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about these issues a lot. And here's my strategy, and I'd love to know what Elizabeth thinks of this. When I graduate and I've got my PhD and I'm going to apply for my postdoc, and they come to me and they say, okay, here's what we can offer you. I'm just going to say, that's great. I will really think about that offer, and it would really help me if you could give me the starting salaries of the last five men that you hired in this position. That would really help me make my decision.
Way to go. Elise, well, that is that the solution to all of this? I love that. It's good.
Well, I think more pay transparency is absolutely vital to being able to close the pay gap sufficiently. And I think that's why we see places that you have more transparency, like what you said about the state of Minnesota and the employees and making sure that there is pay equity. The only way to measure that is transparency. And I think that for firms to be more transparent, not for particular people associated with their salaries, but for particular jobs or occupations within a particular firm, if they share that information. And I think that that could be very useful, it's possible that could be met with information that you can use to negotiate a better salary.
Yeah. I do want to say this before we go back to the lines here. There are some companies that have made this their central mission to solve the pay gap. And the CEO of Salesforce.com, Rhonda and Elise, you probably know about this, took 2 years to bring equity to pay and promotion, and they achieved it by this year. I mean, they thought it was going to take longer than it did. What would it take, Rhonda, for more companies to do this, to follow the lead of a company like that?
My most direct answer, I think, is sheer will and determination, right? I think you have to want to, because I'm not sure that anything else will force it, right? Like a commitment, right, which is clearly what this company did. They looked at their data and they committed to change.
Right.
And if you're not taking a good look at your data and you're not committed to change, I think no matter what Elise continues to study, or myself, or other economists, or even some regulations, if there's not going to be a commitment to making it happen, it's not going to happen.
Call here from
Elise,
go
exactly
ahead. Sure.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's also really important to bring into race and ethnicity into this conversation, because there are pay gaps besides the gender pay gap that are really important to close and that are holding back many families across this country and honestly holding back the economy.
Call here from Suzanne in Minneapolis. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for taking my call. Interesting conversation, and I just wanted to let you guys know you were talking about work culture. And I work in a company that has a ROE environment, and that stands for results-only work environment.
Uh-huh.
So what that means is we're not rewarded for seat time or just, you know, showing up and being present necessarily. We can work anywhere as long as we meet our outcomes and get our work done.
What field are you in, Suzanne?
I'm in education, and that, interestingly, that brings me to another point, which is I still feel like, and, you know, I don't know, feeling is not necessarily measurable, but it seems that mostly it's women that are in education, and education is still looked at as a vocation and not really a profession, and that's, you know, represented by how we're paid.
Right. I really appreciate the call, and that's good news out of your field, though, that it isn't so much about FaceTime. Nicholas says on Twitter, why don't companies use union type of pay scales? I work for UPS. Women work and make the same amount as men. And back to the phones here to Mackenzie in Minneapolis. Hi, Mackenzie. Sounds like you have an experience with this negotiation thing on salaries.
I definitely do, yes. When I was offered my first job in the cities, the wage that they offered me I thought was kind of low, and so I was complaining to my boyfriend at the time, or he's my husband now, and he was like, you know, just negotiate, like, what are you talking about, you know, why is this an issue? And he encouraged, you know, he gave me a number, and I was like, oh, that seems so high, but, you know, I kind of went for it. Sorry, that's my child. And, you know, I negotiated in that way. I sent him an email, and they offered me a significantly higher wage in the end.
Uh-huh.
And instead of being the least paid person in that position, which I would have been,
uh-huh,
had I accepted it, I ended up being the highest paid person.
Aha. Uh-huh. Way to go.
And
that good learning experience there, too. Right. And confidence
really
building. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been a man basically pushing me to negotiate.
Yeah, I was going to point to that notice she said. It was her boyfriend, her current husband, who said, no, you need to ask for more money, right? And I think that is, you know, that's a key, right? Because men are very clear, well, I shouldn't say very clear. I think they get it in ways that we are learning to get it, whether it's really by force in terms of understanding your worth, or force in recognizing that if you are the single breadwinner in your family, that the money that you make has real consequences for the livelihood of your family. But I'd also like to go to something that Elise said in terms of race and equity and bringing that into the conversation.
Uh-huh.
And it is one of the things that I've been thinking about, because in a lot of the studies about the metric for pay equity, it is the white male that the comparison is to. And it is making me... I think that's something that is, again, that is outdated as we're thinking about work culture, because the data is showing that it is actually Asian men who make more money.
Mm.
And so when I consistently see that the earnings are relative to the white male, it makes me think, as this country becomes more and more diverse, what, again, is the role of white privilege in terms of thinking about where everybody else is? Like, white is still the standard for what we should be, whether it is sometimes comparison in education, and clearly with respect to pay equity, not necessarily the person or the group that is the highest paid. And I think that's something that we need to reevaluate.
Rhonda, this is a good opportunity for me to share some other numbers, and I'm really glad you mentioned this. When it comes to the pay gap, when you add women of color into the mix, African-American women, 65 cents to the dollar. And again, as you say, the standard is outdated as well, but that's where the numbers are at the moment. Hispanic women, 59 cents to the dollar. Not a lot of attention's being paid to that either, is it?
No, but I will say I'm pleased that Elise addresses it in her study, and there is some conversation about it. It is what I don't like about the Pay Equity Day in April. It is, as a black woman, it makes me think, okay, so whose Pay Equity Day is this, right? Because clearly it's not for black women or even Asian women who would be earlier than the April date, or for Hispanic women. So, again, I think even when we're talking about women, it is this notion of white women, and in Elise's study, they talk about the typical median male or female earner, and while I get that in quotation marks, I don't know who the typical person is, when we know that for blacks, Hispanics, and Asian, there is some, you know, the numbers aren't necessarily the same as when we're potentially talking about white women. So I do think this notion of pay equity needs to be, I think, even broader than just talking about women, that if we are asking for pay equity, then we need to be asking for pay equity for everyone, not necessarily just women, even though I understand that the disparities are larger for women.
Elise, do you want to speak to that?
Yes. I mean, I think it's a great point. I think it's an interesting point, changing the relative perspective to look at maybe Asian men as higher earning than white men. Certainly, if you compare white men to Asian women are making more than white women are. So I think that's a useful addition to the conversation, Rhonda. Thank you for that. And I think that, you know, even just looking at racial equity, you can see, again, comparing across education, white workers are being paid more than black and Hispanic workers at every level of education. And that gap is larger at the top. You do see those larger gaps, just like we were talking about with the gender wage gap itself. And typical workers, it's true. Typical is a funny construct. You know, we use it to mean the 50th percentile worker when you line up all the workers, regardless of race or gender or ethnicity. I think that that's one thing to reexamine. And I think that the caller earlier made a really good point about his workplace. He was saying he worked at UPS, and they have a union, and they all the women that do the same job as him are being paid the same as he is, with the same amount of experience. And that is certainly true. You can close both gender and racial wage gaps in unionized workplaces. We talked about the typical gap, again, that typical 50th percentile gap. Women are being paid about 83 cents on the male dollar. In a unionized workplace, it's 94 cents. So it's a much smaller pay gap when you look at workplaces that have those sort of public contracts where the wages are set for different occupations.
Luna says on Twitter, the University of Minnesota Women's Center has a great online salary negotiation module with Minnesota data, and I retweeted that, so you can hang out on the link there and check it out. Susan said, thanks for the analysis and the attention on wage gaps. Astoundingly, I see comments from women who believe there's no inequality anymore. And to the phones here to Deborah in Minneapolis. And Deborah, I'm really grateful we had a chance to get you in. Is that you coughing?
Yep, no, that's not me coughing.
Okay. All right, Deborah, go ahead. In just the last couple minutes here, you have a solution.
Yeah, well, I thank you for bringing up Minnesota's pay equity law for the public sector. But I also wanted to note that Minnesota also has the only equal pay certification law in the country for state contractors.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is a really important approach because, as we've been talking about today, there's some significant challenges and consequences for women stepping forward. These kinds of laws sort of flip the burden to the employer to prove that they're meeting equal pay laws. And I just think that's a really important piece in terms of the accountability. And as was discussed earlier, how we're going to get more private sector employers to step up, to review their data on a regular basis and make the changes on an ongoing basis that are necessary to make sure people are getting paid equally.
So Deborah, just so I understand this, it is if the state is going to do business with a contractor, they have to prove these equity issues, yes?
Absolutely. Okay. They have to have an equal pay certification. The CEO has to sign off on it. They're subject to audits. To make sure that that they're actually paying people equally. This is very similar to the Iceland law that's recently been talked about quite a bit.
Right. I mean, the prime minister has proposed a law that would require all companies of more than 25 people to pay men and women the same for the same work. Rhonda, we're all headed to Iceland. Is that the answer? Probably not.
Well, I'm going to Netherlands. No. After hearing someone talk about filming Fast and Furious, no, I don't think I want to go to Iceland. That the cold weather doesn't excite me. But I want to talk about something that you said, and
Rhonda,
I think this is
forgive
also a part
me.
That's missing.
I am so sorry. I am out of time. I threw that question at you, and then I didn't give you time to respond. But I am grateful for your insight and your experience with this. Thank you so much. And Elise, thank you very much. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And this is NPR News.